but not unalluring woman to Wakeman's left, now entered the exchange, stabbing her cigarette in the ashtray as she spoke. This could only be Charlotte Fever. Charlotte the Scarlet, as Oscar called her. She was the last of the Roxborough line, he'd said, unless she found a way to fertilize one of her girlfriends.
"This isn't some damn club he can visit when it fucking well suits him," she said.
"That's right," Wakeman put in. "It's a damn poor show."
Shales picked up one of the newspapers in front of him and pitched it down the table in Dowd's direction.
"I presume you've read about this body they found in Clerkenwell," he said.
"Yes, I believe so." Shales paused for several seconds, his sparrow eyes going from one member to another. Whatever he was about to say, its broaching had been debated before Dowd entered.
"We have reason to believe that this man Chant did not originate in this dominion."
"I'm sorry," Dowd said, feigning confusion. "I don't follow. Dominion?"
"Spare us your discretion," Charlotte Fever said. "You know what we're talking about. Oscar hasn't employed you for 25 years and kept his counsel."
"I know very little," Dowd protested.
"But enough to know there's an anniversary imminent," Shales said.
"My, my," Dowd thought. "They're not as stupid as they look."
"You mean the reconciliation?" he said.
"That's exactly what I mean. This coming midsummer."
"Do we have to spell it out?" Bloxham said. "He already knows more than he should."
Shales ignored the interruption and was beginning again when a voice, so far unheard, emanating from a bulky figure sitting beyond the reach of the light, broke in. Dowd had been waiting for this man, Matthias McGann, to say his piece. If the tabula rasa had a leader, this was he.
"Hubert," he said.
"May I?"
Shales murmured.
"Of course."
"Mr. Dowd," said McGann, "I don't doubt that Oscar has been indiscreet. We all have our weaknesses. You must be his. Nobody here blames you for listening. But this society was created for a very specific purpose, and on occasion has been obliged to act with extreme severity in the pursuit of that purpose. I won't go into details. As Giles says, you're already wiser than any of us would like. But believe me, we will silence any and all who put this dominion at risk."
He leaned forward. His face announced a man of good humour, presently unhappy with his lot.
"Hubert mentioned that an anniversary is imminent. So it is. And forces with an interest in subverting the sanity of this dominion may be readying themselves to celebrate that anniversary. So far, this," he pointed to the newspaper, "is the only evidence we'd found of such preparations. But if there are others, they will be swiftly terminated by this society and its agents. Do you understand?"
He didn't wait for an answer.
"This sort of thing is very dangerous," he went on. "People start to investigate. Academics, esoterics, they start to question, and they start to dream."
"I could see how that would be dangerous," Dowd said.
"Don't smarm, you smug little bastard," Bloxham burst out. "We all know what you and Godolphin have been doing. Tell him, Hubert."
"I've traced some artifacts of non-terrestrial origin that came my way. The trail, as it were, leads back to Oscar Godolphin."
"We don't know that," Lionel put in. "These boogers lie."
"I'm satisfied Godolphin's guilty," Alice Tirrett said. "And this one with him."
"I protest," Dowd said.
"You've been dealing in magic," Bloxham hollered. "Admit it."
He rose and slammed the table.
"Admit it."
"Sit down, Giles,"
McGann said.
"Look at him,"
Bloxham went on, jabbing his thumb in Dowd's direction.
"He's guilty as hell."
"I said sit down,"
McGann replied, raising his voice ever so slightly. Cowed, Bloxham sat.
"You're not on trial here," McGann said to Dowd. "It's Godolphin we want."
"So find him," Fever said.
"And when you do,"
Shales said,
Tell him I've got a few items he may recognize.
The table fell silent. Several heads turned in Matthias McGann's direction.
I think that's it, he said. Unless you have any remarks to make.
I don't believe so, Dowd replied.
Then you may go.
Dowd took his leave without further exchange, escorted as far as the lift by Charlotte Fever, and left to make the descent alone. They were better informed than he'd imagined, but they were some way from guessing the truth. He turned over passages of the interview as he drove back to Regent's Park Road, committing them to memory for later recitation. Wakeman's drunken irrelevances, Shale's indiscretion, McGann, smooth as a velvet scabbard. He'd repeat it all for Godolphin's edification, especially the cross-questioning about the absentee's whereabouts. Somewhere in the east, Dowd had said. East is Orderex, maybe, in the Kesperates, built close to the harbour, where Oscar liked to bargain for contraband brought back from Hakaridek or the islands. Whether he was there or some other place, Dowd had no way of fetching him back. He would come when he would come, and the tabula rasa would have to bide its time, though the longer he was away, the more the likelihood grew of one of their number voicing the suspicion some of them surely nurtured, that Godolphin's dealings in talismans and wantons were only the tip of the iceberg. Perhaps they even suspected he took trips. He wasn't the only fifther who'd jaunted between dominions, of course. There were many routes from Earth to the reconciled dominions, some safer than others, but all used at one time or another, and not always by magicians. Poets had found their way over, and sometimes back, to tell the tale. So had a good number of priests over the centuries, and hermits, meditating on their essence so hard, the in ovo enveloped them and spat them into another world. Any soul despairing or inspired enough could get access. But few in Dowd's experience had made such a commonplace of it as Godolphin. These were dangerous times for such jaunts, both here and there. The reconciled dominions had been under the control of his Orderex's autarch for over a century, and every time Godolphin returned from a trip, he had new signs of unrest to report. From the margins of the First Dominion to Patashokwa and its satellite cities in the Fourth, voices were raised to stir rebellion. There was as yet no consensus on how best to overcome the autarch's tyranny, only a simmering unrest, which regularly erupted in riots or strikes, the leaders of such mutinies invariably found and executed. In fact, on occasion the autarch's suppressions had been more draconian still. Entire communities had been destroyed in the name of the Isordorexian Empire, tribes and small nations deprived of their gods, their lands, and their right to procreate, others simply eradicated by pogroms the autarch personally supervised. But none of these horrors had dissuaded Godolphin from travelling in the reconciled dominions. Perhaps tonight's events would, however, at least until the society's suspicions had been allayed. Tiresome as it was, Dowd knew he had no choice as to where he went tonight, to the Godolphin estate and the folly in its deserted grounds which was Oscar's departure place. There he would wait, like a dog grown lonely at its master's absence, until Godolphin's return. Oscar was not the only one who would have to muster some excuses in the near future, so would he. Killing Chant had seemed like a wise manoeuvre at the time, and of course an agreeable diversion on a night without a show to go to, but Dowd hadn't predicted the furor it would cause. With hindsight, that had been naive. England loved murder, preferably with diagrams, and he'd been unlucky, what with the ubiquitous Mr. Burke of the Somme and a low quota of political scandals conspiring to make Chant posthumously famous. He would have to be prepared for Godolphin's wrath. But hopefully it would be subsumed in the larger anxiety of the society's suspicions. Godolphin would need Dowd to help him calm these suspicions, and a man who needed his dog knew not to kick it too hard.
Chapter 7 1 Gentle called Klein from the airport, minutes before he caught his flight.
He presented Chester with a severely edited version of the truth, making no mention of Esterbrook's murder plot, but explaining that Jude was ill and had requested his presence. Klein didn't deliver the tirade that Gentle had anticipated. He simply observed, rather wearily, that if Gentle's word was worth so little after all the effort he, Klein, had put into finding work for him, it was perhaps best that they end their business relationship now. Gentle begged him to be a little more lenient, to which Klein said he'd call Gentle's studio in 2 days' time, and, if he received no answer, would assume their deal was no longer valid.
"Your dick'll be the death of you," he commented as he signed off.
The flight gave Gentle time to think about both that remark and the conversation on Kite Hill, the memory of which still vexed him. During the exchange itself, he'd moved from suspicion to disbelief, to disgust, and finally to acceptance of Esterbrook's proposal. But despite the fact that the man had been as good as his word, providing ample funds for the trip, the more Gentle returned to the conversation in memory, the more that first response, suspicion, was reawakened. His doubts circled around two elements of Esterbrook's story. The assassin himself, this Mr. Pye, hired out of nowhere, and, more particularly, around the man who'd introduced Esterbrook to his hired hand, Chant, whose death had been media fodder for the past several days. The dead man's letter was virtually incomprehensible, as Esterbrook had warned, veering from pulpit rhetoric to opiate invention. The fact that Chant, knowing he was going to be murdered, that much was cogent, should have chosen to set these nonsenses down as vital information was proof of significant derangement. How much more deranged than a man like Esterbrook, who did business with this crazy, and by the same token was Gentle not crazier still, employed by the lunatic's employer. Amid all these fantasies and equivocations, however, there were two irreducible facts, death and Judith. The former had come to Chant in a derelict house in Clerkenwell, about that there was no ambiguity. The latter, innocent of her husband's malice, was probably its next target. His task was simple, to come between the two. He checked into his hotel at 52nd and Madison a little after 5 in the afternoon, New York time. From his window on the 14th floor he had a view downtown, but the scene was far from welcoming. A gruel of rain, threatening to thicken into snow, had begun to fall as he journeyed in from Kennedy, and the weather reports promised cold and more cold. It suited him, however. The grey darkness, together with the horn and brake squeals rising from the intersection below, fitted his mood of dislocation. As with London, New York was a city in which he'd had friends once, but lost them. The only face he would seek out here was Judith's. There was no purpose in delaying that search. He ordered coffee from room service, showered, drank, dressed in his thickest sweater, leather jacket, corduroys and heavy boots, and headed out. Cabs were hard to come by, and after 10 minutes of waiting in line beneath the hotel canopy, he decided to walk uptown a few blocks and catch a passing cab if he got lucky. If not, the cold would clear his head. By the time he'd reached 70th Street, the sleet had become a drizzle, and there was a spring in his step. 10 blocks from here, Judith was about some early evening occupation, bathing, perhaps, or dressing for an evening on the town. 10 blocks, and a minute a block. 10 minutes until he was standing outside the place where she was. 2. Marlin had been as solicitous as an erring husband since the attack, calling her from his office every hour or so, and several times suggesting that she might want to talk with an analyst, or at very least with one of his many friends who'd been assaulted or mugged on the streets of Manhattan. She declined the offer. Physically, she was quite well. Psychologically, too. Though she'd heard that victims of attack often suffered from delayed repercussions, depression and sleeplessness among them, neither had struck her yet. It was the mystery of what had happened that kept her awake at night. Who was he? This man who knew her name, who got up from a collision that should have killed him outright and still managed to outrun a healthy man. And why had she projected upon his face the likeness of John Zacharias? Twice she began to tell Marlin about the meeting in and outside Bloomingdale's. Twice she'd re-channeled the conversation at the last moment, unable to face his benign condescension. This enigma was hers to unravel, and sharing it too soon, perhaps at all, might make the solving impossible. In the meantime, Marlin's apartment felt very secure. There were two doormen, Sergio by day and Freddy by night. Marlin had given them both a detailed description of the assailant and instructions to let nobody up to the second floor without Ms. Odell's permission, and even then they were to accompany visitors to the apartment door and escort them out if his guest chose not to see them. Nothing could harm her as long as she stayed behind closed doors. Tonight, with Marlin working until 9 and a late dinner planned, she'd decided to spend the early evening assigning and wrapping the presents she'd accumulated on her various Fifth Avenue sorties, sweetening her labours with wine and music. Marlin's record collection was chiefly seduction songs of his 60s adolescence, which suited her fine. She played smoochy soul and sipped well-chilled Sauvignon as she pottered, more than content with her own company. Once in a while she'd get up from the chaos of ribbons and tissue and go to the window to watch the cold. The glass was misting. She didn't clear it. Let the world lose focus. She had no taste for it tonight. There was a woman standing at one of the third-story windows when Gentle reached the intersection, just gazing out at the street. He watched her for several seconds before the casual motion of a hand raised to the back of her neck and run up through her long hair identified the silhouette as Judith. She made no backward glance to signify the presence of anyone else in the room. She simply sipped from her glass and stroked her scalp and watched the murky night. He had thought it would be easy to approach her, but now, watching her remotely like this, he knew otherwise. The first time he'd seen her, all those years ago, he'd felt something close to panic. His whole system had been stirred to nausea as he relinquished power to the sight of her. The seduction that had followed had been both an homage and a revenge, an attempt to control someone who exercised an authority over him that defied analysis. To this day, he didn't understand that authority. She was certainly a bewitching woman, but then he'd known others every bit as bewitching and not been panicked by them. What was it about Judith that threw him into such confusion now, as then? He watched her until she left the window, then he watched the window where she'd been, but he wearied of that, finally, and of the chill in his feet. He needed fortification, against the cold, against the woman. He left the corner and trekked a few blocks east until he found a bar where he put two bourbons down his throat and wished to his core that alcohol had been his addiction, instead of the opposite sex. At the sound of the stranger's voice, Freddy, the night doorman, rose muttering from his seat in the nook beside the elevator. There was a shadowy figure visible through the ironwork filigree and bulletproof glass of the front door. He couldn't quite make out the face, but he was certain he didn't know the caller, which was unusual. He'd worked in the building for 5 years and knew the names of most of the occupants' visitors. Grumbling, he crossed the mirrored lobby, sucking in his paunch as he caught sight of himself. Then, with chilled fingers, he unlocked the door. As he opened it, he realized his mistake. Though a gust of icy wind made his eyes water, blurring the caller's features, he knew them well enough. How could he not recognize his own brother? He'd been about to call him and find out what was going on in Brooklyn when he'd heard the voice and the rapping on the door.
"What are you doing here, Fly?"
Fly smiled his missing toothed smile.
"Thought I'd just drop in," he said. "You got some problem?"
"No, everything's fine," Fly said.
Despite all the evidence of his senses, Freddy was uneasy. The shadow on the step, the wind in his eye. The very fact that Fly was here when he never came into the city on weekdays, it all added up to something he couldn't quite catch hold of.
"What do you want?" he said. "You shouldn't be here."
"Here I am, anyway," Fly said,
stepping past Freddy into the foyer.
"I thought you'd be pleased to see me."
Freddy let the door swing closed, still wrestling with his thoughts. But they went from him the way they did in dreams. He couldn't string Fly's presence and his doubts together long enough to know what one had to do with the other.
I think I'll take a look around,
Fly was saying, heading towards the elevator.
Wait up! You can't do that!
What am I going to do? Set fire to the place?
I said no!
Freddy replied, and blurred vision notwithstanding, went after Fly, overtaking him to stand between his brother and the elevator. His motion dashed the tears from his eyes, and as he came to a halt he saw the visitor plainly.
"You're not Fly," he said.
He backed away towards the nook beside the elevator where he kept his gun, but the stranger was too quick. He reached for Freddy and, with what seemed no more than a flick of his wrist, pitched him across the foyer. Freddy let out a yell, but who was going to come and help? There was nobody to guard the guard. He was a dead man. Across the street, sheltering as best he could from the blasts of wind down Park Avenue, Gentle, who'd returned to his station barely a minute before, caught sight of the doorman scrabbling on the foyer floor. He crossed the street, dodging the traffic, reaching the door in time to see a second figure stepping into the elevator. He slammed his fist on the door, yelling to stir the doorman from his stupor.
"Let me in! For God's sake, let me in!"
Two floors above, Jude heard what she took to be a domestic argument, and not wanting somebody else's marital strife to sour her fine mood, was crossing to turn up the soul song on the turntable when somebody knocked on the door.
"Who's there?"
she said. The summons came again, not accompanied by any reply. She turned the volume down instead of up and went to the door, which she dutifully bolted and chained. But the wine in her system made her incautious. She fumbled with the chain and was in the act of opening the door when doubt entered her head. Too late. The man on the other side took instant advantage. The door was slammed wide, and he came at her with a speed of the vehicle that should have killed him two nights before. There were only phantom traces of the lacerations that had made his face scarlet, and no hint in his motion of any bodily harm. He had healed miraculously. Only the expression bore an echo of that night. It was as pained and as lost, even now as he came to kill her, as it had been when they'd faced each other in the street. His hands reached for her, silencing her scream behind his palm.
"Please," he said.
If he was asking her to die quietly, he was out of luck. She raised her glass to break it against his face, but he intercepted her, snatching it from her hand.
"Judith,"
he said. She stopped struggling at the sound of her name, and his hand dropped from her face.
"How the fuck do you know who I am?"
"I don't want to hurt you," he said.
His voice was downy, his breath orange-scented. The perversest desire came into her head, and she cast it out instantly. This man had tried to kill her, and this talk now was just an attempt to quiet her till he tried again.
"Get away from me!"
"I have to tell you."
He didn't step away, nor did he finish. She glimpsed a movement behind him, and he saw her look, turning his head in time to meet a blow. He stumbled but didn't fall, turning his motion to an attack with balletic ease and coming back at the other man with tremendous force. It wasn't Freddy, she saw. It was Gentle, of all people. The assassin's blow threw him back against the wall, hitting it so hard he brought books tumbling from the shelves. But before the assassin's fingers found his throat, he delivered a punch to the man's belly that must have touched some tender place, because the assault ceased and the attacker let him go, his eyes fixing for the first time on Gentle's face. The expression of pain in his face became something else entirely. In some part horror, in some part awe, but in the greatest part some sentiment for which she knew no word. Gasping for breath, Gentle registered little or none of this, but pushed himself up from the wall to relaunch his attack. The assassin was quick, however. He was at the door and out through it before Gentle could lay hands on him. Gentle took a moment to ask if Judith was all right, which she was, then raced in pursuit. The snow had come again, its veil dropping between Gentle and Pye. The assassin was fast, despite the hurt done him, but Gentle was determined not to let the bastard slip. He chased Pye across Park Avenue and west on 80th, his heels sliding on the sleet-slickened ground. Twice his quarry threw him backward glances, and on the second occasion seemed to slow his pace, as if he might stop and attempt a truce, but then thought better of it and put on an extra turn of speed. It carried him over Madison towards Central Park. If he reached its sanctuary, Gentle knew, he'd be gone. Throwing every last ounce of energy into the pursuit, Gentle came within snatching distance. But even as he reached for the man, he lost his footing. He fell headlong, his arms flailing, and struck the street hard enough to lose consciousness for a few seconds. When he opened his eyes, the taste of blood sharp in his mouth, he expected to see the assassin disappearing into the shadows of the park. But the bizarre Mr. Pye was standing at the curb looking back at him. He continued to watch as Gentle got up, his face betraying a mournful empathy with Gentle's bruising. Before the chase could begin again, he spoke, his voice as soft and melting as the sleet.
"Don't follow me," he said.
"You leave her! The fuck alone!" Gentle gasped, knowing even as he spoke he had no way of enforcing this edict in his present state.
But the man's reply was affirmation.
"I will," he said. "But please, I beg you, forget you ever set eyes on me."
As he spoke, he began to take a backward step, and for an instant Gentle's dizzied brain almost thought it possible the man would retreat into nothingness, be proved spirit rather than substance.
"Who are you?"
he found himself asking.
"Pye or Pa,"
the man returned, his voice perfectly matched to the soft expellations of those syllables.
"But who?"
"Nobody and nothing,"
came the second reply, accompanied by a backward step. He took another and another, each pace putting further layers of sleet between them. Gentle began to follow, but the fall had left him aching in every joint, and he knew the chase was lost before he'd hobbled 3 yards. He pushed himself on, however, reaching one side of Fifth Avenue as Pye O'Parr made the other. The street between them was empty, but the assassin spoke across it as if across a raging river.
"Go back," he said, "or if you come, be prepared."
Absurd as it was, Gentle answered as if there were white waters between them.
"Prepared for what?"
he shouted. The man shook his head, and even across the street, with the sleet between them, Gentle could see how much despair and confusion there was on his face. He wasn't certain why the expression made his stomach churn, but churn it did. He started to cross the street, plunging a foot into the imaginary flood. The expression on the assassin's face changed. Despair gave way to disbelief, and disbelief to a kind of terror, as though this fording was unthinkable, unbearable. With Gentle halfway across the street, the man's courage broke. The shaking of the head became a violent fit of denial, and he let out a strange sob, throwing back his head as he did so. Then he retreated, as he had before, stepping away from the object of his terror, Gentle, as though expecting to forfeit his visibility. If there was such magic in the world, and tonight Gentle could believe it, the assassin was not an adept. But his feet could do what magic could not. As Gentle reached the river's other bank, Pye O'Parr turned and fled, throwing himself over the wall into the park without seeming to care what lay on the other side. Anything to be out of Gentle's sight. There was no purpose in following any further. The cold was already making Gentle's bruised bones ache fiercely, and in such a condition the 2 blocks back to Jude's apartment would be a long and painful trek. By the time he made it, the sleet had soaked through every layer of his clothing. With his teeth chattering, his mouth bleeding, and his hair flattened to his skull, he could not have looked less appealing as he presented himself at the front door. Jude was waiting in the lobby with a shame-faced doorman. She came to Gentle's aid as soon as he appeared, the exchange between them short and functional. Was he badly hurt? No. Did the man get away? Yes.
"Come upstairs," she said. "You need some medical attention."
3. There had been too much drama in Jude and Gentle's reunion already tonight for them to add more to it, so there was no gushing forth of sentiment on either side. Jude attended to Gentle with her usual pragmatism. He declined a shower but bathed his face and wounded extremities, delicately sluicing the grit from the palms of his hands. Then he changed into a selection of dry clothes she'd found in Marlin's wardrobe, though Gentle was both taller and leaner than the absent lender. As he did so, Jude asked if he wanted to have a doctor examine him. He thanked her but said no, he'd be fine. And so he was, once dry and clean, aching but fine.
"Did you call the police?"
he asked, as he stood at the kitchen door watching her brew Darjeeling.
"It's not worth it," she said. "They already know about this guy from the last time. Maybe I'll get Marlin to call them later."
"This is his second try?"
She nodded.
"Well, if it's any comfort, I don't think he'll try again."
"What makes you say that?"
"Because he looked about ready to throw himself under a car."
"I don't think that'd do him much harm," she said,
and went on to tell him about the incident in the village, finishing up with the assassin's miraculous recovery.
"He should be dead," she said. "His face was smashed up. It was a wonder he could even stand. Do you want sugar or milk?"
"Maybe a dash of scotch. Does Marlin drink?"
"He's not a connoisseur like you."
Gentle laughed.
"Is that how you describe me? The alcoholic Gentle?"
"No. To tell the truth, I don't really describe you at all," she said, slightly abashed. "I mean, I'm sure I've mentioned you to Marlin in passing, but you're a guilty secret."
This echo of Kite Hill brought his horror to mind.
"Have you spoken to Esterbrook?" he said.
"Why should I do that?"
"He's been trying to contact you."
"I don't want to talk to him."
She put his tea down on the table in the living room, sought out the scotch and set it beside the cup.
"Help yourself," she said.
"You're not having a dram?"
"Tea but no whiskey. My brain's crazed enough as it is."
She crossed back to the window, taking her tea.
"There's so much I don't understand about all of this," she said. "To start with, why are you here?"
"I hate to sound melodramatic, but I really think you should sit down before we have this discussion."
"Just tell me what's going on," she said, her voice tainted with accusation. "How long have you been watching me?"
"Just a few hours."
"I thought I saw you following me a couple of days ago."
"Not me. I was in London until this morning."
She looked puzzled at this.
"So what do you know about this man who is trying to kill me?"
"He said his name was Pai O Pa."
"I don't give a fuck what his name is," she said,
her show of detachment finally dropping away.
"Who is he? Why does he want to hurt me?"
"Because he was hired."
"He was what?"
"He was hired by Esterbrook."
Tea slopped from her cup as a shudder passed through her.
"To kill me?" she said. "He hired someone to kill me? I don't believe you. That's crazy."
"He's obsessed with you, Jude. It's his way of making sure you don't belong to anybody else."
She drew the cup up to her face, both hands clutched around it, the knuckles so white it was a wonder the china didn't crack like an egg. She sipped, her face obscured. Then, the same denial, but more flatly.
"I don't believe you."
"He's been trying to speak to you to warn you. He hired this man, then changed his mind."
"How do you know all of this?"
Again, the accusation.
"He sent me to stop it."
"Hired you too?"
It wasn't pleasant to hear from her lips, but yes, he said he was just another hireling. It was as though Esterbrook had set two dogs on Judith's heels, one bringing death, the other life, and let fate decide which caught up with her first.
"Maybe I will have some booze," she said,
and crossed to the table to pick up the bottle. He stood to pour for her, but his motion was enough to stop her in her tracks, and he realized she was afraid of him. He handed her the bottle at arm's length. She didn't take it.
"I think maybe you should go," she said. "Marlin'll be home soon. I don't want you here."
He understood her nervousness, but felt ill-treated by this change of tone. As he'd hobbled back through the sleet, a tiny part of him had hoped her gratitude would include an embrace, or at least a few words that would let him know she felt something for him. But he was tarred with Esterbrook's guilt. He wasn't her champion. He was her enemy's agent.
"If that's what you want," he said.
"It's what I want."
"Just one request. If you tell the police about Esterbrook,
Will you keep me out of it?
Why? Are you back at the old business with Klein?
Let's not get into why. Just pretend you never saw me.
She shrugged. I suppose I can do that.
Thank you, he said. Where did you put my clothes?
They won't be dry. Why don't you just keep the stuff you're wearing?
Better not, he said, unable to resist a tiny jab. You never know what Marlin might think. She didn't rise to the remark, but let him go and change. The clothes had been left on the heated towel rack in the bathroom, which had taken some of the chill off them, but insinuating himself into their dampness was almost enough to make him retract his jibe and wear the absent lover's clothes. Almost, but not quite. Changed, he returned to the living room to find her standing at the window again, as if watching for the assassin's return.
"What did you say his name was?" she said.
"Something like Pi O Pa."
"What language is that? Arabic?"
"I don't know."
"Well, did you tell him Esterbrook had changed his mind? Did you tell him to leave me alone?"
"I didn't get a chance," he said lamely.
"So he could still come back and try again?"
"Like I said, I don't think he will."
"He's tried twice. Maybe he's out there thinking third time lucky. There's something unnatural about him, Gentle. How the hell could he heal so fast?"
"Maybe he wasn't as badly hurt as he looked." She didn't seem convinced.
"A name like that. He shouldn't be difficult to trace."
"I don't know. I think men like him, they're almost invisible."
"Marlin'll know what to do."
"Good for Marlin."
She drew a deep breath. "I should thank you, though," she said, her tone as far from gratitude as it was possible to get.
"Don't bother," he replied. "I'm just a hired hand. I was only doing it for the money."
4. From the shadows of a doorway on 79th Street, Pi O Pa watched John Fury Zacharias emerge from the apartment building, pull the collar of his jacket up around his bare nape, and scan the street north and south, looking for a cab. It was many years since the assassin's eyes had taken the pleasure they did now, seeing him. In the time between, the world had changed in so many ways, but this man looked unchanged. He was a constant, freed from alteration by his own forgetfulness, always new to himself and therefore ageless. Pi envied him. For Gentle, time was a vapour, dissolving hurt and self-knowledge. For Pi, it was a sack into which each day, each hour, dropped another stone, bending the spine until it creaked. Nor, until tonight, had he dared entertain any hope of release. But here, walking away down Park Avenue, was a man in whose power it lay to make whole all broken things, even Pi's wounded spirit. Indeed, especially that. Whether it was chance or the covert workings of the unbeheld that had brought them together this way, there was surely significance in their reunion. Minutes before, terrified by the scale of what was unfolding, Pi had attempted to drive Gentle away and, having failed, had fled. Now such fear seemed stupid. What was there to be afraid of? Change? That would be welcome. Revelation? The same. Death? What did an assassin care for death? If it came, it came. It was no reason to turn from opportunity. He shuddered. It was cold here in the doorway, cold in the century, too, especially for a soul like his, that loved the melting season, when the rise of sap and sun made all things seem possible. Until now he'd given up hope that such a burgeoning time would ever come again. He'd been obliged to commit too many crimes in this joyless world. He'd broken too many hearts. So had they both, most likely. But what if they were obliged to seek that elusive spring for the good of those they'd orphaned and anguished? What if it was their duty to hope? Then his denying of this near reunion, his fleeing from it, was just another crime to be laid at his feet. Had these lonely years made him a coward? Never. Clearing his tears, he left the doorstep and pursued the disappearing figure, daring to believe as he went that there might yet be another spring, and a summer of reconciliations to follow.
Chapter 8. When he got back to the hotel, Gentle's first instinct was to call Jude. She'd made her feelings towards him abundantly clear, of course, and common sense decreed that he leave this little drama to fizzle out. But he glimpsed too many enigmas tonight to be able to shrug off his unease and walk away. Though the streets of this city were solid, their buildings numbered and named, though the avenues were bright enough even at night to banish ambiguity, he still felt as though he was on the margin of some unknown land, in danger of crossing into it without realizing he was even doing so. And if he went, might Jude not also follow? Determined though she was to divide her life from his, the obscure suspicion remained in him that their fates were interwoven. He had no logical explanation for this. The feeling was a mystery, and mysteries weren't his specialty. They were the stuff of after-dinner conversation, when, mellowed by brandy and candlelight, people confessed to fascinations they wouldn't have broached an hour earlier. Under such influence he'd heard rationalists confess their devotion to tabloid astrologers, heard atheists lay claim to heavenly visitations, heard tales of psychic siblings and prophetic deathbed pronouncements. They'd all been amusing enough, in their way, but this was something different. This was happening to him, and it made him afraid. He finally gave in to his unease. He located Marlin's number and called the apartment. The lover boy picked up. He sounded agitated and became more so when Gentle identified himself.
"I don't know what your goddamn game is," he said.
"It's no game," Gentle told him.
"You just keep away from this apartment."
"I've no intention, because if I see your face, I swear, can I speak to Jude?"
"Judith's not—"
"I'm on the other line," Jude said.
"Judith, put down the phone. You don't want to be talking with this scum."
"Calm down, Marlin."
"You heard her, Mervyn. Calm down."
Marlin slammed down the receiver.
"Suspicious, is he?" Gentle said.
"He thinks this is all you're doing."
"So you told him about Esterbrook?"
"No, not yet."
"You're just going to blame the hired hand, is that it?"
"Look, I'm sorry about some of the things I said. I wasn't thinking straight. If it hadn't been for you, maybe I'd be dead by now."
"No maybe about it," Gentle said. "Our friend Pye meant business."
"He meant something," she replied. "But I'm not sure it was murder."
"He was trying to smother you, Jude."
"Was he? Or was he just trying to hush me? He had such a strange look."
"I think we should talk about this face to face," Gentle said. "Why don't you slip away from Loverboy for a late night drink? I can pick you up right outside your building. You'll be quite safe."
"I don't think that's such a good idea. I've got packing to do. I've decided to go back to London tomorrow."
"Was that planned?"
"No. I'd just feel more secure if I was at home."
"Is Mervyn going with you?"
"It's Marlin. And no, he isn't."
"More fool him."
"Look, I'd better go. Thanks for thinking of me."
"It's no hardship," he said. "And if you get lonely between now and tomorrow morning..."
"I won't."
"You never know. I'm at the Omni, room 103. There's a double bed."
"You'll have plenty of room, then."
"I'll be thinking of you," he said.
He paused, then added,
"I'm glad I saw you."
"I'm glad you're glad."
"Does that mean you're not?"
"It means I've got packing to do. Good night, Gentle."
"Good night."
"Have fun."
He did what little packing of his own he had to do, then ordered up a small supper, a club sandwich, ice cream, bourbon, and coffee. The warmth of the room after the icy street and its exertions made him feel sluggish. He undressed and ate his supper naked in front of the television, picking the crumbs from his pubic hair like lice. By the time he got to the ice cream, he was too weary to eat, so he downed the bourbon, which instantly took its toll, and retired to bed, leaving the television on in the next room, its sound turned down to a soporific burble. His body and his mind went about their different businesses. The former, freed from conscious instruction, breathed, rolled, sweated, and digested. The latter went dreaming. First, of Manhattan served on a plate, sculpted in perfect detail,
then of a waiter speaking in a whisper, asking if Sir wanted night, and of night coming in the form of a blueberry syrup, poured from high above the plate and falling in viscous folds upon the streets and towers. Then, gentle walking in those streets, between those towers, hand in hand with a shadow, the company of which he was happy to keep, and which turned when they reached an intersection and laid its feather finger upon the middle of his brow, as though Ash Wednesday were dawning. He liked the touch, and opened his mouth to lightly lick the ball of the shadow's hand. It stroked the place again. He shuddered with pleasure, wishing he could see into the darkness of this other and know its face. In straining to see, he opened his eyes, body and mind converging once again. He was back in his hotel room. The only light, the flicker of the television, reflected in the gloss of a half-open door. Though he was awake, the sensation continued, and to it was added sound, a milky sigh that excited him. There was a woman in the room.
"Jude?" he said.
She pressed her cool palm against his open mouth, hushing his inquiry even as she answered it. He couldn't distinguish her from the darkness, but any lingering doubt that she might belong to the dream from which he'd risen was dispatched as her hand went from his mouth to his bare chest. He reached up in the darkness to take hold of her face and bring it down to his mouth, glad that the murk concealed the satisfaction he wore. She'd come to him. After all the signals of rejection she'd sent out at the apartment, despite Marlin, despite the dangerous streets, despite the hour, despite their bitter history, she'd come, bearing the gift of her body to his bed. Though he couldn't see her, the darkness was a black canvas, and he painted her there to perfection, her beauty gazing down on him. His hands found her flawless cheeks. They were cooler than her hands, which were on his belly now, pressing harder as she hoisted herself over him. There was everywhere in their exchange an exquisite synchronicity. He thought of her tongue and tasted it. He imagined her breasts, and she took his hands to them. He wished she would speak, and she spoke. Oh, how she spoke! Words he hadn't dared admit he'd wanted to hear.
"I had to do this," she said.
"I know, I know.
Forgive me."
"What's to forgive?"
"I can't be without you, Gentle. We belong to each other, like man and wife."
With her here so close after such an absence, the idea of marriage didn't seem so preposterous. Why not claim her now and forever?
"You want to marry me?" he murmured.
"Ask me again another night," she replied.
"I'm asking you now."
She put her hand back upon that anointing place in the middle of his brow.
"Hush," she said. "What you want now, you might not want tomorrow."
He opened his mouth to disagree, but the thought lost its way between his brain and his tongue, distracted by the small circular motions she was making on his forehead. A calm emanated from the place, moving down through his torso and out to his fingertips. With it, the pain of his bruising faded. He raised his hands above his head, stretching to let bliss run through him freely. Released from aches he'd been accustomed to, his body felt new-minted, gleaming invisibly.
"I want to be inside you," he said.
"How far?"
"All the way."
He tried to divide the darkness and catch some glimpse of her response, but his sight was a poor explorer and returned from the unknown without news. Only a flicker from the television, reflected in the gloss of his eye and thrown up against the blank darkness, lent him the illusion of a luster passing through her body, opaline. He started to sit up, seeking her face, but she was already moving down the bed, and moments later he felt her lips on his stomach, and then upon the head of his cock, which she took into her mouth by degrees, her tongue playing on it as she went, until he thought he would lose control. He warned her with a murmur, was released, and, a breath later, swallowed again. The absence of sight lent potency to her touch. He felt every motion of tongue and tooth in play upon him, his prick, particularized by her appetite, becoming vast in his mind's eye until it was his body's size, a veiny torso and a blind head lying on the bed of his belly, wet from end to end, straining and shuddering, while she, the darkness, swallowed him utterly. He was only sensation now, and she its supplier, his body enslaved by bliss, unable to remember its making or conceive of its undoing. God, but she knew how he liked to be pleasured, taking care not to stale his nerves with repetition, but cajoling his juice into cells already brimming until he was ready to come in blood and be murdered by her work, willingly. Another skitter of light behind his eye broke the hold of sensation, and he was once again entire, his prick its modest length, and she not darkness, but a body through which waves of iridescence seemed to pass. Only seemed, he knew. This was his sight-starved eye's invention. Yet it came again, a sinuous light sleeking her, then going out. Invention or not, it made him want her more completely, and he put his arms beneath her shoulders, lifting her up and off him. She rolled over to his side, and he reached across to undress her. Now that she was lying against white sheets, her form was visible, albeit vaguely. She moved beneath his hand, raising her body to his touch.
"Inside you," he said,
rummaging through the damp folds of her clothes. Her presence beside him had stilled. Her breathing lost its irregularity. He bared her breasts, put his tongue to them as his hands went down to the belt of her skirt, to find that she'd changed for the trip and was wearing jeans. Her hands were on the belt almost as if to deny him, but he wouldn't be delayed or denied. He pulled the jeans down around her hips, feeling skin so smooth beneath his hands it was almost fluid, her whole body a slow curve like a wave about to break over him. For the first time since she'd appeared she said his name, tentatively, as though in this darkness she'd suddenly doubted he was real.
"I'm here," he replied, "always."
"This is what you want," she said.
"Of course it is. Of course,"
he replied, and put his hand on her sex. This time the iridescence, when it came, was almost bright, and fixed in his head the image of her crotch, his fingers sliding over and between her labia. As the light went, leaving its afterglow on his blind eyes, he was vaguely distracted by a ringing sound, far off at first, but closer with every repetition. The telephone. Damn it. He did his best to ignore it, failed and reached out to the bedside table where it sat, throwing the receiver off its cradle and returning to her in one graceless motion. The body beneath him was once again perfectly still. He climbed on top of her and slid inside. It was like being sheathed in silk. She put her hands up around his neck, her fingers strong, and raised her head a little way off the bed to meet his kisses. Though their mouths were clamped together, he could hear her saying his name.
"Gentle? Gentle?"
With that same questioning tone she'd had before. He didn't let memory divert him from his present pleasure, but found his rhythm, long, slow strokes. He remembered her as a woman who liked him to take his time. At the height of their affair, they'd made love from dusk to dawn on several occasions, toying and teasing, stopping to bathe so they'd have the bliss of working up a second sweat. But this was an encounter that had none of the froth of those liaisons. Her fingers were digging hard at his back, pulling him onto her with each thrust, and still he heard her voice, dimmed by the veils of his self-consumption.
"Gentle? Are you there?"
"I'm here,"
he murmured. A fresh tide of light was rising through them both, the erotic becoming a visionary toil as he watched it sweep over their skin, its brightness intensifying with every thrust. Again she asked him,
"Are you there?"
How could she doubt it? He was never more present than in this act, never more comprehending of himself than when buried in the other sex.
"I'm here,"
he said. Yet she asked again, and this time, though his mind was stewed in bliss, the tiny voice of reason murmured that it wasn't his lady who was asking the question at all, but the woman on the telephone. He'd thrown the receiver off the hook, but she was haranguing the empty line, demanding the reply. Now he listened.
There was no mistaking the voice. It was Jude. And if Jude was on the line, who the fuck was he fucking? Whoever it was, she knew the deception was over. She dug deeper into the flesh of his lower back and buttocks, raising her hips to press him deeper into her still, her sex tightening around his cock as though to prevent him from leaving her unspent. But he was sufficiently master of himself to resist and pulled out of her, his heart thumping like some crazy locked up in the cell of his chest.
"Who the hell are you?"
he yelled. Her hands were still upon him, their heat and their demand, which had so aroused him moments before, unnerved him now. He threw her off and started to reach towards the lamp on the bedside table. She took hold of his erection as he did so and slid her palm along the shaft. Her touch was so persuasive he almost succumbed to the idea of entering her again, taking her anonymity as carte blanche and indulging in the darkness every last desire he could dredge up. She was putting her mouth where her hand had been, sucking him into her. He regained in two heartbeats the hardness he'd lost. Then the whine of the empty line reached his ears. Jude had given up trying to make contact. Perhaps she'd heard his panting and the promises he'd been making in the dark. The thought brought new rage. He took hold of the woman's head and pulled her from his lap. What could have possessed him to want somebody he couldn't even see? And what kind of whore offered herself that way? Diseased? Deformed? Psychotic? He had to see. However repulsive, he had to see. He reached for the lamp a second time, feeling the bed shake as the harridan prepared to make her escape. Fumbling for the switch, he brought the lamp off its perch. It didn't smash, but its beams were cast up at the ceiling, throwing a gauzy light down on the room below. Suddenly fearful she'd attack him, he turned without picking the lamp up, only to find that the woman had already claimed her clothes from the snarl of sheets and was retreating to the bedroom door. His eyes had been feeding on darkness and projections for too long, and now, presented with solid reality, they were befuddled. Half concealed by shadow, the woman was a mire of shifting forms, face blurred, body smeared, pulses of iridescence slow now, passing from toes to head. The only fixable element in this flux was her eyes, which stared back at him mercilessly. He wiped his hand from brow to chin in the hope of sloughing the illusion off, and in these seconds she opened the door to make her escape. He leapt from the bed, still determined to get past his confusions to the grim truth he'd coupled with, but she was already halfway through the door, and the only way he could stop her was to seize hold of her arm. Whatever power had deranged his senses, its bluff was called when he made contact with her. The roiling forms of her face resolved themselves like pieces of a multifaceted jigsaw, turning and turning as they found their place, concealing countless other configurations, rare, wretched, bestial, dazzling, behind the shell of a congruous reality. He knew the features now that they'd come to rest. Here were the ringlets framing a face of exquisite symmetry. Here were the scars that healed with such unnatural speed. Here were the lips that hours before had described their owner as nothing and nobody. It was a lie. This nothing had two functions at least, assassin and whore. This nobody had a name. Pi-o-pa! Gentle let go of the man's arm as though it were venomous. The form before him didn't redissolve, however, for which fact Gentle was only half glad. That hallucinatory chaos had been distressing, but the solid thing it had concealed appalled him more. Whatever sexual imaginings he'd shaped in the darkness, Judith's face, Judith's breasts, belly, sex, all of them had been an illusion. The creature he'd coupled with, almost shot his load into, didn't even share her sex. He was neither a hypocrite nor a Puritan. He loved sex too much to condemn any expression of lust, and though he'd discouraged the homosexual courtships he'd attracted, it was out of indifference, not revulsion. So the shock he felt now was fueled more by the power of the deceit worked upon him than by the sex of the deceiver.
"What have you done to me?"
was all he could say.
"What have you done?"
Pi-o-pa stood his ground, knowing perhaps that his nakedness was his best defence.
"I wanted to heal you,"
he said. Though it trembled, there was music in his voice.
You put some drug in me.
No,
Pye said. Don't give me no. I thought you were Judith. You let me think you were Judith.
He looked down at his hands, then up at the hard, lean body in front of him.
I felt her, not you.
Again the same complaint.
What have you done to me?
I gave you what you wanted, Pye said.
Gentle had no retort to this. In its way, it was the truth. Scowling, he sniffed his palms, thinking there might be traces of some drug in his sweat. But there was only the stench of sex on him, of the heat of the bed behind him.
You'll sleep it off, Pye said.
Get the fuck out of here, Gentle replied, and if you go anywhere near Jude again, I swear I'll take you apart.
You're obsessed with her, aren't you?
None of your fucking business.
It'll do you harm.
Shut up.
It will, I'm telling you.
I told you, Gentle yelled. Shut the fuck up!
She doesn't belong to you,
came the reply. The words ignited new fury in Gentle. He reached for Pye and took him by the throat. The bundle of clothes dropped from the assassin's arm, leaving him naked, but he put up no defence. He simply raised his hands and laid them lightly on Gentle's shoulders. The gesture only infuriated Gentle further. He let out a stream of invective, but the placid face before him took both spittle and spleen without flinching. Gentle shook him, digging his thumbs into the man's throat to stop his windpipe. Still he neither resisted nor succumbed, but stood in front of his attacker like a saint awaiting martyrdom. Finally, breathless with rage and exertion, Gentle let go his hold and threw Pye back, stepping away from the creature with a glimmer of superstition in his eyes. Why hadn't the fellow fought back, or fallen? Anything but this sickening passivity.
Get out,
Gentle told him. Pye still stood his ground, watching him with forgiving eyes.
Will you get out?
Gentle said again, more softly, and this time the martyr replied.
If you wish.
I wish.
He watched Pye Opar stoop to pick up the scattered clothes. Tomorrow this would all come clear in his head, he thought. He'd have shat this delirium out of his system, and these events, Jude, the chase, his near rape at the hands of the assassin, would be a tale to tell Klein and Clem and Taylor when he got back to London. They'd be entertained. Aware now that he was more naked than the other man, he turned to the bed and dragged a sheet off it to cover himself with. There was a strange moment, then, when he knew the bastard was still in the room, still watching him, and all he could do was wait for him to leave. Strange because it reminded him of other bedroom partings, sheets tangled, sweat cooling, confusion and self-reproach keeping glances at bay. He waited and waited, and finally heard the door close. Even then he didn't turn, but listened to the room to be certain there was only one breath in it, his own. When he finally looked back and saw that Pye Opar had gone, he pulled the sheet up around him like a toga, concealing himself from the absence in the room, which stared back at him too much like a reflection for his peace of mind. Then he locked the suite door and stumbled back to bed, listening to his drugged head whine like the empty telephone line. Chapter 9. 1. Oscar Esmond Godolphin always recited a little prayer in praise of democracy when, after one of his trips to the Dominions, he stepped back onto English soil. Extraordinary as those visits were, and as warmly welcome.